Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com.
We're coming to the end of 1 Samuel. Originally, 1 Samuel was just one book, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, one book known as the Kingdoms. And eventually, when it was a Hebrew scroll, it would just be a large scroll that you'd be able to wind up. But at some point, they moved from scrolls to be able to have books. And once you start looking to bind books, then you have to, you're limited on how big you can go. You don't want to be carrying around a big book, so why not cut it in half? So that's what happened there. But 1 Samuel, as we know it, is coming to an end and winding down as we're thinking about Saul's reign, chapter 29 out of 31. And these last chapters are somewhat short compared to some of them. You remember chapter 17, very large chapter. But here, 29, we find ourselves just with 11 verses or so. But as you think about this great end that's coming, often when you think about reading a book, it's often that this story travels throughout the whole book up to this one last battle that's going to come. You think about any real book that's, you know, one that comes to mind for me is Moby Dick. Right from the start, this story starts about this rivalry between King Ahab and this great white whale, Moby Dick. And over, this tension builds and builds and builds and builds up to these last chapters where this epic battle, this epic chase is finally coming to a close. But here in chapter 29, this battle that's leading up, this battle that we know is going to be the demise of Saul because of last week's chapter, we know this is coming, but yet here's a big turn. A big turn right at the end, kind of like at the end of Moby Dick. You're kind of maybe, it depends on who you're going for at the end of that book. I won't ruin the ending. You can go read about it yourself. But I think one of the most great endings of one of the novels. But here in chapter 29, we see David and he moves to the land of the Philistines. He partners with Achish. And you know the lies and deceptions that he took making those, the choices that David has made. And then asking the question, what do you think is going to happen? What do you think is going to happen to David? Now, there's one interesting aspect that I just want to quickly go over here in this, before we turn to chapter 29, is the nation of the Philistines, in the book of 1 Samuel. They've actually played quite a pivotal role throughout the whole book that has actually turned and curbed a lot of the direction in which it was going to begin with. Now, you could spend a whole study looking at the Philistines, where they come from, where they're going, what they did as nations historically throughout the Bible, through the book of Judges. They play a pretty critical role. It's the Philistines that are they're in charge when Samson is there. But here, just quickly go through 1 Samuel and see how they have played such an important role, how God has used them to be able to change the direction and turn the direction of how things are going. Remember chapters 4 and 5, that here Eli's house is told that it would crumble because of Eli's son. They're worthless men. But here, and God is going to carry out this destruction of Eli's house, that Ichabod, God has departed. And in chapter 7, Samuel says to all the house of Israel, if you're returning to the Lord with all your heart, put away the foreign gods and Ashtaroth from among you and direct your heart to the Lord and serve him only, and he will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines. So you have the Philistines changing the direction to have stealing the ark, fulfilling God's word to be able to bring destruction on Eli's house. Eli's sons fall to the Philistines in battle. And then you have here Samuel coming to power, and he says that if you serve God and God alone, God will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines. It's God that's going to do this. It's not the Philistines coming up to power and God's thinking, well, how am I going to defeat them? Well, maybe if I dangle a carrot in front of the Israelites' face, then I can maybe then answer a prayer for them. But after this, the Philistines go hiding again, this rise and triumph of chapter 4 and 5. Then in chapter 7, they go. Chapter 11, the Ammonites come up. That's where Saul defeats them. We'll see them come be reminded of that in a couple of weeks. But here the Philistines come back up in chapter 13. Jonathan defeats the garrison of the Philistines. Chapter 14 again. Goliath, this big epic battle that we remember, he is the gladiator for the Philistines. It's not merely just David and Goliath, it's Israel versus the Philistines. Here's this again, this rising of what's coming up. But then the famous song started in chapter 18. As they're coming back, it's about David and what David has done. He has struck down the Philistine, the Goliath, and the women came out of the city singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines and songs of joy and the musical instruments. And the women sang to one another, celebrating, Saul has struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s. When they're talking about this, they're talking about Philistines. And then you remember Saul's plan to destroy David. Saul's plan was to be able to use the Philistines for his advantage to be able to strike down David. And we, you know, that's a good plan. Go throw them in the midst of battle. And God, but God doesn't let them happen, as we'll look in a couple of weeks, how the hand of God has been throughout this whole book. But Saul thought, let me give him to her, that she may be a snare for him, and the hand of the Philistines may be against him. And again, later in that chapter, verse 25, now Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. This is his plan. But again, God's using the Philistines for his ordained everything that shall come to pass. And again, they play a very vital role throughout the whole book. Saul flees to Gath in the first time. And you remember that great escape as they're chasing down and they're on that mountain. And David's on one side and Saul's on the other. And right at that very moment, when Saul thought, God has given David into my hands, the Philistines have made a raid against the land. Saul returned from pursuing after David and went against the Philistines. Therefore, that place was called the Rock of Escape. Again, vital in that shift of that story from going from the Philistines are winning to Israel is winning. The Philistines are coming back up again. Jonathan defeats them. David and Goliath, and then they're rising again. They come right at that right time. In critical moments throughout the book of 1 Samuel, even throughout the book of Judges, the Philistines play a vital role in the nation of Israel. As Proverbs says, that the harps of kings is like the stream of water. And this is what it seems like, the Philistines coming and going throughout the book, and God directing his hand. And now we come to chapter 29. And it gives us context of what has actually happened in chapter 29. And the Philistines had gathered their forces at Aphek, and the Israelites were encamped at the spring of Jezreel. So here they're up, kind of up to the northern side of Judah, where Judah kind of is in the midst where Samaria is in the New Testament. And here they are. The Philistines are gathered at Aphek, right down in the coast near a near where Philistia is, down that lower corner. And then the Israelites are at the spring of Jezreel. So, but as you can remember, last couple of weeks ago when we looked at chapter 28, the Philistines encamped at Shunem. And Saul gathered Israel and encamped at Gilboa. So, Shunem and Gilboa, they're kind of... that's where the Israelites are at Jezreel, and they come down to Mount Gilboa, and that's where Saul will die in 31. So we need to remember that chapter 28, although it comes before this instance in chapter 29, in our book, in our Bible, it actually follows afterwards. That they camp in Jezreel, and then they go down to Gilboa. They're in Aphek. But they end up moving in Shuem at the in chapter 28. So this is, although it follows, this is a bit of a taste of what's happening. Saul has not yet gone to speak at the witch or that lady at Endor, just to give us a little bit of context. But Aphek is another important location. And that, again, this reminder that it's not merely just about historical details that we find out in the Bible. The author, Gad, I think at this point, tells us they go in a camp at Aphek. And the reason they go at camp at Aphek is in 1 Samuel 4. Remember, right before the fall of Eli's house had been prophesied that that is what's going to happen. Right before the fall of Eli's house, the word came to Samuel, to all of Israel. Now, Israel went to battle against the Philistines, and they were camped at Ebenezer. And the Philistines encamped at Aphek. So here, it's already bringing up these ideas of what's happened. Remember chapter 4? They go into battle. They take the ark into battle. They fall. The Philistines get the ark. Ichabod, the glory has departed. Eli's house has been told that it's going to crumble. It's going to fall because of his worthless sons. And we already know, because chapter 28 has come before, that Saul's house is going to fall. That it's going to happen at this. So this, again, the glory has departed. These are the ideas that are going through in your head that come up in the first verse of chapter 29. It's not merely just telling you historical importance of where they encamped, which they did, but it's also bringing us to these theological points, reminding us of what happens to Eli's house is going to happen to Saul's house. What happened to Eli's house, his sons died. This is what's going to happen to Saul. It gives us what is happening. And then we move to after that context is given to verses 2 to 5, the inspection from the lords. The inspection from the lords. As the lords of the Philistines were passing by on by hundreds and thousands, and David and his men were passing to the rear with Achish, the commanders of the Philistines, "What are these Hebrews doing here?" And Achish said to the commanders of the Philistines, "Is this not David, the servant of Saul, king of Israel, who has been with me now for days and years? And since he deserted to me, I have found no fault in him to this day." But the commanders of the Philistines were angry with him, and the commanders of the Philistines said to him, "Send the man back, that he may return to the place to which you have assigned him. He shall not go down with us to battle, lest in the battle he become an adversary to us. For how could this fellow reconcile himself to his lord? Would it not be with the heads of the men here? Is not this David, of whom they sing to one another in dances? Saul has struck down his thousands, and David his 10,000s. So here their army is encamped at Aphek, and the lords of the Philistines start going through inspecting the troops. Two notes of what's actually happening here. First, what they're actually doing when they go and inspect the troops. You're down in Aphek, and then what you're doing is you're evaluating the situation. You know where the Israelites are. You might have sent out spies to be able to go inspect what they're like. As you remember in Numbers, I believe it is, when they're going to inspect the land, and Moses sends 12 spies to go into the land, and he tells them what they're looking for. And they come back and they say, "Well, they're too big. They're too strong. It's not worth us going in to defeat them." And Joshua and Caleb are the only two that say, "We can do this. This is, the Lord has blessed us. We can go. It is exactly what God has told us and promised us." And this is the inspection. They would have gone and looked at the army of Israel and evaluated their situation. You don't have to fight right now. You can take it by time. These are your, you know, you don't want to lose men. You're going to lose some men in war, but you want to evaluate the situation before you go in and fight. You want to go inspect the troops. Not only you want to go inspect the other troops, but you want to find out about your troops. Are they fit? Do they have swords? You know, you go and have a look at them and they're, not very fit. They don't have any weapons. They're not well trained. It's not worth going to go defeat them. One, because the high casualty, but then also the embarrassment that it will bring on your country. So they're going and inspecting the troops. Now, we don't know how many men there are at this point. Maybe 3,000, maybe 6,000. We have no idea about how many men there are. We're told that they're lined up in hundreds and thousands. So we don't know exactly how much they are. But did you know that in our country, in the army, we actually have an office of the Inspector General of the Army? And his role is to not only just inspect troops and make sure that it's fit, but also to handle complaints and things like that, to make sure that the standards that the Army set are kept. But the second thing we need to note is, who are the lords of the Philistines? Here it says the lords of the Philistines go inspect these armies. So we need to understand who they are. And quite simply, they're governors of cities in what they call a pentapolis, which is pent is five, and then polis, which is city, so pentapolis. So in the Philistine area, Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, Ekron, and Gath. All these areas have a lord over them, a governor over them, and it's kind of like this alliance between, I would use the word confederate, agreement, alliances between here, but what they are is, that's what makes up this nation, that these lords come and inspect them, they each bring their troops, and united they can come one. And that's what we see in Joshua, the start of Joshua, in 13. It explains these five rulers of the Philistines, these lords, come up, and here's the army that they're looking at. So you have these kings or these governors over these city, and they form these alliances. Remember in Genesis, Sodom and Gomorrah, and they have these five cities that are united, and they go up against these four kings of the northeast that come down and they fight. These alliances happen quite often. We do it all the time too. We have allies that are friends with our armies. Most of the time they're joining the Americans because the Americans are strong. You want to be on the strong person's side, and that's normally how we get them. But here, and they know, and they see David there at the end of the line, and they see David waiting, and they start to inspect the troop, and they're wondering why Achish, the king of Gath, one of these lords of the army, lords of the Philistine, has David and his men there. And they remember hearing a song that has been sung, this pop hit of the 1020 BCs or whatever. It must have been a catchy tune because it went through everyone. Everyone knew this song. Everyone had heard about Saul, and everyone had heard about David. Everyone had heard about what he had done. And here they come through and they say, is this not David, whose master, whose Lord is Saul? And they think about it. Saul has killed his thousands, but David has killed his 10,000 Philistines. They're brothers, cousins, they're soldiers. This is the person, and he's now in our army? Surely this is not what is happening. Surely this is not the best plan. And I think the Philistines are right. He's been there for 16 months, and he thinks his loyalty to another nation is just going to change instantly, especially to someone who has destroyed your gladiator, killed thousands of your men, tens of thousands of your men. And they said, send him away. It's too much risk for us. In the midst of battle, you have these 300, 600 men at the back of the line, and they turn to escape. And here you have David and his men ready to turn on you at any moment. So I think the lords of the Philistines are pretty smart in sending them home. So then Achish then has to tell David this news in verses 6 to 7. Then Achish called David and said to him, as the Lord lives, you have been honest, and to me it seems right that you should march out and in with me in the campaign. For I have found nothing wrong in you from the day you're coming to me to this day. Nevertheless, the Lord's do not approve of you. So go back now and go peaceably that you may not displease the lords of the Philistines. So Achish then goes and tells David this news that, they've had a meeting. I get one vote out of five. There's four other men here that get to be able to say a vote, and they don't want you here. They do not approve of you. Maybe more literally, if you translate it, it might be, you do not look good in their sight. You don't look like you're good in their sight. And I think Achish here is making a very political move, which is wise on his part, just as wise as it is on the lords of Philistines not to involve David. It's also wise on his part. You've got four people that you've got an allegiance with, an alliance with, and what is David? If you upset David, you've got 600 men on your side. If you upset these four lords, you've got a larger army that's going to do this. So it's not worth separating us for these four other kings from this alliance. This has been going on since even the time of the conquest in Joshua, to be able to then separate this alliance that seems to be working pretty well politically. They're pretty strong throughout the time of Judges and then throughout the time of 1 Samuel. So he tells them to go back to Ziklag. Now, before we turn to David's surprising response, now let us again remind ourselves of how the Lord is using this situation, the five lords of the Philistines, the four saying no, and Achish even signing on and saying with that the Philistines are being used to be able to shift the story, to be able to change the direction of what is happening. Now, David has made some very bad decisions up to this point. We've looked at this. It is Achish that says, as the Lord lives, the Lord doesn't flow from David's mouth during this time. He is walking away from God, it seems, on the external appearance. And in this situation, even though his response has been foolish throughout this time, let us try and think about the outcome. David goes get exactly what he wants at this point. He goes to war with the Philistines. And then all of Israel sees him. He stood out to the Philistines as they went through and marched on the battle. How much is he going to stand out to the people in Israel? How would that work out for him in the long run? As Achish thinks in his mind that he's gone out and done all these raids and already made enemies with Israel. But that's not true. He hasn't wiped out any Israelites. He hasn't taken them. If David does go to war, then what happens to God's people? Who would he be striking down? He'd been striking down the Israelites. The people who he is anointed as king, although he doesn't sit on the throne yet. He's anointed as king as the shepherd king who would come and care for the sheep. But yet, the Lord, large capitals, Yahweh, is using these small lords to be able to change the course of history, so to speak. We know what does happen, but it also doesn't take us long to imagine what could have happened. And before, David is told when he's in Gath, when he's hiding out, he's told by the prophet Gad to go back to the forest Herith. But now, God is not using his own prophet, Gad, to be able to instruct David. He's using the secondary means of these five lowercase lords being able to tell him to get out of here. And now David just simply asks questions in verse 8. David said to Achish, "But what have I done? What have you found in your servant from the day I entered your service until now, that I may not go and fight against the enemies of my lord, the king?" Now, what an interesting turn. How many of us were standing on the line of a battlefront, about to enter into a gory fight, life and death, and we've just been given a get out of jail free card. Go home. Take the rest of the day off. How many of us would say, "Well, can I just fight just a little? Please, just one Philistine, one Israelite." Most of us would say, "My pleasure. I'll go." But yet David, in this instance, asks three questions. He turns to Achish, "What have I done? What have you found in your servant from the day I entered your service until now that I may not go up and fight against the enemies of my king. Maybe he's worried about his lie and he might get caught in his lie. He wants to prove his loyalty. One commentary explained it maybe has this double meaning that David is saying when he says to fight against the enemies of my Lord, the King. Maybe he's saying the words, my Lord and King. And Achish is thinking he is their Lord and King. But David is actually saying, I'm going to fight against my Lord and King. But there's a double meaning here. You're hearing, I'm going to be loyal to you. But I'm going to be loyal to my Lord and my King. Or is it to Saul? I'm going to be loyal to my Lord, Saul, the Lord's anointed, as David calls him, and King. Ultimately, I think he can be reading too much into this. We don't know the meaning of what's happening. The author doesn't use the word Yahweh, so it probably isn't saying, he's not saying, fight against my Lord Yahweh, but he uses the word Adonai, which is more master, lowercase Lord. But again, just pointing out that David's response in this point really is wandering far away from God. He's not necessarily living that that sanctified life of that believer who's dying to sin, who's moving forward in that growing in grace. He's one of weakness, and I think this response is one of these times where he continues in that weakness, where he desperately wants to be able to do what his heart's desire, and his heart's desire at this moment, and he thinks at this point, the best thing for him is to be on the Philistines' side. He doesn't know what's coming, and we'll see. But then Achish reassures David in verses 8, 9, and 10. And Achish answered David and said, I know that you are blameless in the sight as an angel of God. Nevertheless, the commanders of the Philistines have said, he shall not go up with us to the battle. Now then, rise early in the morning with your servants of the Lord who came with you, and start early in the morning, and depart as soon as you have light. Achish is not moved by this. He responds quite simply and just says that you are blameless in my sight. Now, David has been lying at this point to Achish right from the beginning, it seems. He'd been going and making raids on these other these areas, and Achish thinks he's going into Judah. He's going in and wiping out Israelites. But here, Achish is blind to what David is actually doing. David is lying. David has not been honest and upfront with him. He's blameless in Achish's sight, but he doesn't know the whole picture. But yet, Achish doesn't back down. He doesn't refuse. He very bluntly says, this is what the lords of the Philistines want. You need to leave, and you need to leave as soon as you have light. Again, what a wise move from Achish's point. Why have this internal battle and not even make it to fight Israel? You're going to have a battle here in effect and not even make it up the coastland to be able to go and attack them. So finally, David listens in last verse, and he set out his men early in the morning to return to the land of the Philistines. But the Philistines went up to Jezreel. So David at this point, it's not what he wants. He wants to be able to go fight in this battle, to be by Achish's side, to show his loyalty to him. I don't know how he thought this would work out in the end. How do you disguise yourself in battle to be able to hide from slaughtering Israelites? Do you hide behind trees and just wait until everyone's gone and then finally come out and pretend you fought other people? It's not what David wants at this point. And we know life after David. But it seems like at this point it's very strange providence in David's life. He's on the run from Saul from chapter 18. He's not knowing what tomorrow will bring. He's not knowing what is around the corner. And he's lived in the land of the Philistines for 16 months. And he's somewhat made his home there. He's comfortable there. Yet as we all know, we might be able to give advice. We don't know exactly what the Lord is doing. It is always hard when the response comes back from our prayer request when the door is shut, when the answer is no. It's hard when the bad news has been delivered to us. When we're going and interviewing in churches, this would come in time and time again. I'd apply for a church. They'd get a phone call interview or a follow-up interview with them. I'd talk with them, answer questions, and then maybe get invited to preach. And all these times it's like, well, is this where God is opening the door for us? Is this where God wants to lead us? But then eventually that last phone call comes and they say, well, we've decided to go with a different candidate. That doesn't mean that phone call doesn't become less hard. It's hard to digest. It's hard to be told no. But in that point, between that no and that yes, it's always difficult. You don't know what's around the corner. You don't know what that providence might bring. And trusting in God is difficult in seasons. Especially when you think you've got your own plan and you're following your own plan. You've got it all worked out in your head. Maybe you don't have it worked out in your head, but you're gung-ho about it. You think you've got it anyway. You'll take whatever is thrown at you, and then this no comes. This slammed door. And this is what happens here at Ephek. David thinks he's got his next couple of 5-year plan, 10-year plan, whatever it is, worked out. But yet, David is sent on his way. And I think this passage shows a very important theological theme that flows through the book of 1 Samuel, but also the whole Bible. That even though through God uses secondary means, through God's hand, He changes the hearts of kings like a stream of water. And we can look at many hypotheticals. What if David had stayed? But yet, God still uses Achish and the 5 lords of the Philistines to be able to send David back home. Ultimately, I think most of the hypotheticals, if we were to run them through, would end up with David either on the run or dead. Most likely dead. Yeah. But yet, here he uses this to be able to save his life. Samuel Rutherford writes these letters. He lived in the 17th century. And he has this book of this collection of letters that he wrote to congregants and people that he knew. And he explains that God's providence is like a thread that's hanging. And it's a very, very thin thread. And it looks like it's going to break at any moment. But he said that all of hell could be pulling on that one thread, but because it's the thread of God, the providence of God, it will never break. God's thread will not be broken. God, in this chapter, changes the course of history using secondary means, pagan kings, to be able to shift to save David's life. And we might be able to speculate some of the reasons the Lord had David removed from battle. There's future tension or changes with charges of treason by the Israelites. He would have died. Wouldn't have ended well for Saul and Jonathan. What do you remember in chapter 28, verse 19, where he says, this is what's going to happen to you. And right at the very end of what Samuel, who raised from the dead, says to Saul, he says, the Lord will give the army of Israel into the hand of the Philistines. What's going to happen to David at that point? But yet, here's the providence that in chapter 30, we find out that he's sent home. He's sent home to deal with the Amalekites that are days away that he's able to chase down to be able to catch. But it's anticlimactic in some way. You're expecting this big epic battle to come and fall where the kingship falls in David's lap. But I think that's the reason why the story just doesn't end at the end of 1 Samuel. The reason why we have 2 Samuel. That the happily ever after isn't just David sitting on the throne. The promise of God has not yet been fulfilled. The true king of Israel, the true son of David, has not yet come. I'm always reminded, one of my favorite Old Testament verses is just the chapter of Isaiah, chapter 55. It's a short chapter, but in verses 8 and 9, he explains, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither your ways are my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." And when we think about God's providence, we might be thinking, we've got it. We know the way. We know the direction. We know what's going to happen. And God says, no. Your ways are not my ways. Your thoughts are not my thoughts. I don't know how tall the atmosphere is from the earth to when space begins. But it's a long way. It's a fur piece. And that's how high God's thoughts are about our thoughts. You have to talk down to some children. But yet, we can never talk down to God. His thoughts are way higher than ours. And that, I'm extremely grateful for chapters like this to be reminded how God's providence, through the hands of pagan kings, can direct and save God's people, especially David.
Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com. Seven Springs Presbyterian Church began in 1874 and is a congregation of the Presbyterian Church in America located in Glade Spring, Virginia. Please join us for worship on Sunday at 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. for His glory and His gospel.